and came to the call of a book of prayers, a praise, or in the yogi side they call it mantra. Mantra is a form of prayer or affirmation which you repeat over and over, or you chant it. The basic science behind it is repetition, which is known in some language to represent the word japa or simran. It simply means repetition. Now, Yogananda said, if you take sound and repeat it over and over, it has the effect of spiritualizing the sound until you become identified with the sound. Then you and the sound are one and the same. Now, in the beginning was the word, and that is sound. And the word was with God, that's in consciousness. And the word is God. Two are identified as one. When a human being does the same identical thing, he has brought into focus the power of God on a human level for the first time. The Book of Psalms is designed to bring about this application in daily life. But if you look at the spelling of the word psalm, you see it's a very interesting phenomenon. If you spell the word P-S-I-A-L-M, we have Psalm. The word is spelled P-S-A-L-M. And A-L-M in English is arms or aid. And P-S would be a certain type of aid, a psi. So we are in a sense saying to ourselves, we are generating extrasensory aid, a psi or psychic aid. And psychic means that it is outside of the range of the sensory nature. If we can generate this aid by understanding it, then we have to understand the mechanics to generate it. Now, the human brain cannot generate any force by itself simply by stating it and forgetting it, unless that brain is trained to concentrate and to forget immediately. There's no human being has that type of capacity to think of an idea, release it immediately, and forget it. This takes a great deal of concentration and training and meditation to be able to think of a thought and forget it immediately and let it come into manifestation. So psalms are repeated to bring up that potential force, spiritualize that force and set it in motion. And if we generate it, we become identified with it sooner or later. What we are aiming at in understanding the psalms, that they can only function or work for us if they are done in a repetitive manner. Otherwise, they don't have the power. Simply by ordinary individuals, who will just repeat it once again. And the psalms were not written by ordinary men, they were written by initiates, especially the Psalm of David. The author of the book of the Psalms sometimes referred to David, but there were over 150 psalms, and only 73 are accredited to David. We say accredited, that means it's possible that David might have used them. It's not possible that David might originate them. We don't know if David really originated the psalm. There's no evidence of that. But it's possible that David did use them, did bring them into consciousness, and apply them. Now, but this is by far the larger number than those ascribed to any other author. David is also responsible for the early collections of psalms, for liturgical purposes in the services of the sanctuary. So we see that David was also a student of Manipura Yoga in a form. Now, yoga antedates Christianity, antedates Judaism, and way back into time. There is no evidence when yoga ever began. And the sound knowledge of the initiate life, no one can actually trace its origin. So if David had to use it, he had to have it from some other source. Now, David had to be descended from a lineage of people who were practicing some science. So we go back to other authors specifically mentioned Moses. Now Moses antedated David. So Moses might have brought these psalms with him. Now where did Moses get these psalms? He didn't just go up into Mount Sinai and suddenly came up with the inspiration. He was also trained in the Egyptian knowledge. So the psalms must have antedated Moses too. Solomon, Asaph, and the sons of Asaph, and the sons of Korah, Heman, Ethan, and a Babylonian captive. Now you see the psalms are already attributed to other people who were non-Jews too. Approximately 50 psalms are anonymous. No one knows their origin or who contributed them. What is known as precautionary psalms are the cries of the oppressed for justice. That represent the righteous desire for vengeance upon their foes. In their literal meaning, the spirit of Christianity frowns upon their use, but they were appropriate for the spirit of the age and the conditions of Israel when they were written. But then again, we do not understand the psalm if we are judging it from the so-called churchianistic view. The psalm is not written primarily in a literal sense. It's written in three levels: physical, electrical, ideational. And the only way you can understand them, you have to be an initiate to understand its mechanics and see how it really works to bring about extrasensory aid. Now we can drop the I from the word P-S-I-A-L-M and end up with P-S-A-L-M. And making it easier to pronounce in English, psalm. So, the theme of the psalm, though they're a collection of 150, constitutes prayer and praise. Prayer means to affirm, praise to mean identify or become one with. And they are the prayer and praise, or the affirmation or identification of the people of Israel. They are indeed revelations of divine truth, subtle workings of the consciousness of the mind, written not abstractly, but in the terms of human experience. So this had to be an initiate life. It was not assumption, it was something that had to happen in their lives, and that they were able to apply and work with. They are filled with spiritual truths brought into the emotions, aspirations, sufferings, hopes, and faith of individual authors. So these were actual psychic experiences. They were emotional experiences and they were spiritual experiences. And often the experience of those experiences by people of Israel as a whole. The whole nation had to take part in it. Inasmuch as circumstances and experiences of which they were wrought were representative of the common experiences of God's people throughout all time, the Book of Psalms is really an inexhaustible treatise of religion. Now, it doesn't say what kind of religion. The Book of Psalms deals with the science of religion. Religion as a science. Therefore, we see now we are going back to what yoga really is, mantra yoga, or the science of sound forces, is the real science of religion. the science of sound, how sound comes into manifestation, how sound is utilized by the human being, and how sound sustains the universe. There is no other religion but the religion of sound and light. No man has seen God but felt his presence, and the sun declared him. That means the realized man. He alone declares what God is to every man. Because the realized man has to realize God first before he can declare what God is. He alone can confirm God for you. You can be experiencing God and know not if you experience it or don't even know. The slightest understanding what it is you experience, yet you're experiencing him all the time. Until someone who understands the experience and can confirm it for you or declare it to you, you would have no concept, no understanding. And with greater spiritual fervor and call to modern religious life, than this marvelous Hebrew hymn book. It is loved, used, and revered by Christendom University. Within these holy poems, every element of revealed religion is found. Law, history, prophecy, satisfaction, sanctification, all with the dominant elements of praise and prayer. From the holy utterances, men have always found spiritual communion with God, aspiration, faith, hope, and assurance. In other words, the psalm is the book of affirmation on a positive scale of how to apply thought patterns to raise or lower the effectiveness of your consciousness on your environment, how to modify situations in the environment that confront you. First, we'll take Psalm 1, because this is the most impressive psalm to be placed as 1. No one knows the reason why it was given the first place. But what is unusual about it, it's called the Psalm of the Happiness of the Godly. Godly people are supposed to be happy, and how they achieve this happiness. Since it's a prayer and a praise, then it's an affirmation and a oneness, and this induces or releases happiness individual who is attuned. It starts out with the word blessed. Blessed is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful. Now this is a very specific type of behavior for a human being who is confined to an environment that challenges every emotional nature that you've got, every feeling, every quality, aspiration to bring you into a state of blessedness or happy. We can say it in another way. Instead of said, blessed is the man, we can say, happy is the man that does not walk nor seek the counsel of wrong-thinking people, negative people, nor stand in the and join in their company. That's the way of sinners, getting together and backbiting and criticizing. Nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful, or join together and criticize or judge. That man is happy if you don't find himself in that type of circumstances. So, happiness for the true mental health is achieved by an individual not involving with people who try to tear down others, criticize, or become scornful of one another. But his delight, now a delight is a joy, that man is happy and joyful now. In the law of the Lord. Now the law of the Lord is love. If you're happy and joyful, you're going to express love. There's nothing greater than this expression of love, from joy and happiness. These three forces come into manifestation. Happiness, joy, love. They go together. The person is happy, the person is joyful, and he expresses love. And that will be his delight. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law, that is, in his love, that he meditate day and night. Now, the Maharishi had nothing over these people. Once we come to the word meditate, we find it's the first word being emphasized what a man must do day and night. It covers every period of his existence. Meditation is not a new thing. It is the actual communion with the Spirit. God is Spirit. We cannot worship Him outside of the Spirit. And meditation is that spiritual power which we bring to the surface from within ourselves day and night. Now, meditation is not prayer. Big difference between prayer and meditation. We pray when we send out a thought asking the creative intelligence or the divine consciousness for something, expecting it to happen. So prayer is a sort of a transmission of a broadcasting nature. But this is specifying something else. Meditate. This is something you have to be on the receiving end. Happy is the man that walketh not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor standeth in the way of sinners, nor sitteth in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. He finds joy by doing something, by being attuned. Now, a law is something we obey. We don't tell the government how to make laws. A law is set into motion and we obey. We're not constantly making it, we are constantly obeying it or adhering to it. If we are obeying it or adhering to it, then it's something that we have surrendered ourselves to. It's something that we are attuned to. It's something that has come into our nature as a part of ourselves. We have made it a part of our existence. So the delight would be the obedience. The delight would be the involvement. The delight would be the utilization of it, the experience of it. So, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law, in this particular adherence, this particular observance or expression of it, does he meditate day and night? Does he surrender himself to it day and night? Does he attune himself to it day and night? So what is he tuning himself to? He's attuning himself to love, the principle of love. And he shall be like a tree. That would follow as a result. If you adhere to a certain principle, you'll be like a some distinct permanent function. You're a man of the truth, you're a man of the law, you would be staunch, you would be self-erect. A tree is something that supports the adherence. It will obey, it's not going to fall over overnight. Something you can rely on, trust, seeing if you're standing in the ground. He'd be like a tree planted by the rivers of water. Well, if a tree is planted by a river and the water is pulling it and it's not, don't have any proper roots, before you know the tree will be torn down by the currents. But if it has proper roots and it's nourished, that tree is staunch, sturdy, upright. So this constant surrendering day and night tends to strengthen the consciousness. And it's watered by it, because it's close to the source of nourishment, that bringeth forth his fruit in his season. Everyone has got a certain time, a certain period, in which to realize his true nature. That's the fruit. Realizing your true nature the season is that particular time. No two people can realize themselves at the same time. Each one of us realize it at different times. This is because we are all unique, we're all different, we're all functioning with different attitudes, needs, desires. And his leaf also shall not wither. That means that portion of the individual nature. The leaf is the nature of the plant, which you recognize it, the foliage, the covering. It shall not wither. That means it don't break down. The character, the nature, or the characteristic of the human being don't wither away or easily dismayed or aggravated. It is synchronized with the spirit. It maintains its coverage. It maintains its outer shape, its outer behavior. It has strength for the first time. And whatsoever he doeth shall prosper. Now, this is an unusual state. If the plant is nourished and the leaves don't wither, it stands the reason that's going to bloom. And when it blooms, you'll have fruit. That reminds me of my boy tomato plant. Someday it's going to bloom. We'll have tomatoes. As long as these aren't withering, that says pure life is going on, and he's going to have good vibrations. Eventually he's going to have fruit. This is true in the spiritual life. If you are maintaining that attitude of meditation,
back and forth. They will be a victim of what is called mind
wandering. The individual who is negative, you will see them by their behavior of body patterns. They're fidgeting, searching for something, never satisfied, never happy with one idea or a few moments of inner peace or inner calmness where they are. They're constantly reaching out, searching for something else, never coming to completeness of joy in the one thing they're involved with before they start something else. They have what we call the grasshopper mind. They start eating an apple, then they're ready to eat a pear, and before they eat the pear, they're ready to eat a squash. Never having a complete meal out of any one of these three things. Before you know it, at the end of the day, they've eaten about 60 different objects, and they are totally dissatisfied. So we call that the ungodly mind, or the untuned mind, the untrained mind, the mind wandering. Therefore, the ungodly shall not stand in the judgment. That means they can't stand the test when they're confronted. They're easily swayed, broken down by oppression. Environmental stress causes them to collapse, the mind wanderers. Since the mind has a tendency to wander, it has no strength. Therefore, it cannot utilize right sense of judgment. Therefore, it will make mistakes based upon this wishy-washy action. Nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. Meaning they can't congregate with people of right thinking. They can't stand to be near people who think right. If you get one right thinking person and two not right thinking people, you're going to have a tug of war. One will say, you got to eat meat. The other will say, you got to drink alcohol. Now, what are you trying to be? Teetotal, don't drink meat or eat meat. So they're going to try to sway you to their way of thinking. And before you know it, there's a constant battle going on between you and them. Equally thought patterns of desire cravings are going to be in conflict with yours. They're going to be constantly drawing you to waste away the energy inside of your mechanism. But they can't help you if you get sick. They will lead you down the merry path to fill your senses to get sick. But when you do get sick, they can't help you. Sometimes you're lucky that they get sick before you. Or vice versa, you get sick before them. So that's not a good deal after all. So the parrot once said when he was shot after flying around, eating the corn, and he was enticed away from his master's home. Bad company, bad company, bad company. So human beings have a tendency to trick us to their level, intentionally or not intentionally, simply because they are in that level of mind wandering. If you're capable of raising your consciousness up all the time, then your consciousness will be stable. Now we see in the sixth verse it says, for the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. Now, the way of the righteous is what way? If the Lord knows the way of the righteous, what does the Lord really know? And what is the way of the righteous? The Lord really knows only one thing, love. And his way is surrender to that love. That means become attuned and identified to that love. But the way of the ungodly shall perish. Because if you don't have love to start with, you're going to have hate. Hate will lead to anger, anger will lead to violence, and violence will lead to complete decimation of yourself. That means to perish. You will actually destroy yourself through your own wrong thinking. Now, love will lead to only one thing, expansion, multiplication, improvement, and finally, establishment or identification, permanency. Therefore, it does not go out of existence. Love tends to produce something permanent, whereas the opposite would tend to produce something that is not permanent and it will be destroyed by its own nature. We see this in human behavior. So, the two types of people that are really existing, according to Sri Yukteswar, are the godly and the ungodly, the negative or the positive. The negative people are those who are constantly thinking constructively to destroy themselves. Interesting, huh? How negative people think constructively to destroy themselves. You never did realize that negative people can constructively think to destroy themselves. Negative people are drawn by their ideas, by their wishes, their desire patterns, and they construct many games with themselves to avoid being identified or to become stable. They create many games to become detached from being involved with something constructive or a positive nature, but get involved in constructing things that will tear down, criticize, or continue to criticize, eventually tearing down their own selves. Now, such attitudes are often called by the lawyers premeditated. The man premeditated the murder of his brother. You see, it's something that he pre-did. Now, they use the word premeditate. He doesn't pre-think. It's interesting how, in legal terms, we come back to the word premeditated murder. It was premeditated by the individual. Constructively set up to negatively destroy himself. If we understand that, then we can see what type of people we are dealing with all the time. We're dealing with negative people who tend to construct patterns of thinking to destroy themselves. If we are positive people, we are constructing patterns to lift ourselves up. Now, what is interesting about this psalm, it ends right there, describing the two types of people in the universe. It doesn't go any further. Plain number one psalm, starting off telling us of the two types of individuals that exist around us. It's an outright affirmation of what you have to deal with as a human being. Those who constructively generate thought patterns to destroy others, and those who constructively generate patterns to lift up others. There are only two types, there's no more. Now, if you're involved in the construction of tearing down yourself, you are considered negative or ungodly. If you're involved in constructing to lift up others and thereby lifting yourself up, you are called godly or positive thinkers. Now the results of the two are different types of happiness. Both people get happiness. Negative people get a sort of happiness which others fail. They are sick, but they're happy when you see others fail, because they would like to go around making others fail, simply because they might have failed at one time and could not succeed, and they would do like the fox who got his tail caught in the trap and bit off his tail and ran and told all the rest, bobtail foxes are better looking than those with the natural tails. So he wants everybody to join the group because he lost his tail. Now, the natural fox don't see that as a real truth, because he was born natural to live with his natural tail. Why should he want to chop off his tail? Just to, because of misfortune. So the negative person sometimes finds joy in getting other people involved in the negativeness. We see this in addiction, or individuals who try to addict others to their way of negative thinking. In today's society, we find your dope pushers, dope peddlers, are constantly trying to induce other people all the way down to utilize the substance to tear them down. And thus they get their joy and they get their livelihood out of it. Now you look at the opposite of the scale. Those who are constantly combating or trying to lift up others, what are they really doing? They have to get a joy too. But now, in the two joys, we come back to a statement in the scriptures. The joy of the unrighteous and the joy of the righteous. That means the joy of right-thinking men versus the joy of the wrong-thinking men. Now, the joy of the wrong-thinking men will perish. Because there is no way wrong-thinking men can surpass right-thinking men. But they are powerful enough. Powerful enough to even make us feel their presence and threaten us with their presence. Unless we stand firm like the tree rooted in the waters, nourishing itself and at the same time capable of withstanding this tremendous current and pull of that water. There's nothing as strong as water moving against the earth, against something that will push it away. Now if it's anchored, it's really anchored. And a right thinking man has got to stand on those type of ground. A ground that is treacherous, a ground that is not firm, but it's got to be anchored in such a way that it's not carried away. You've got to have some ideal to which you are rooted to in order to withstand the unrighteous thinking of men, the negative thinking of men. Now, our well-wishers often wish that we are good by saying, poor Johnny, he's doing so bad these days. Poor Mary, she's making a mess of her life. We hear them, they're wishing us well by saying us, calling us poor right away. Now, they're creating constructively the destructive powers that go on to hurt these people. People are constantly generating these thoughts by saying it into the atmosphere and affecting others. Now, the right-thinking person will not refer to another person as poor, because the right-thinking person wants the other person to prosper. And it states that the right-thinking person should prosper. This is the fruit of his thinking. So if he wants to prosper, he wants every other person to prosper. So he has to think of every other person prospering in that dimension. Therefore, the Lord knoweth the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. That doesn't say he does not know the way of the negative thought pattern. He knows the way of negative thought pattern. Consciousness is aware that anything that is negative will sooner or later rot. Now, let's say you're a negative person and you have two sacks of potatoes. One sack starts to rot. One sack remains good. No matter how negative you are, would you eat the rotten potatoes? You can be very negative, but you know that these are absolutely no good for consumption. You'll throw it away. If in your own consciousness as a human being, negative or positive, you will not consume that substance, then how can you expect thought patterns to be sustained by people around you? And how can you expect yourself to be sustained and live in the world with people around you to a full experience? Sooner or later you're going to discover that you are destroying yourself. You are creating social suicide. Negativeness will generate social suicide at one time. It may take a long time, but eventually this pattern is there. The God Self knows that. It knows the difference between the two. patterns of existence. One pattern must destroy itself, or finally stop acting that way. The other pattern must sustain itself. Now we got Psalms number 2. It's called the Kingdom of Christ. We're not talking of Jesus. We're talking of the intelligence in nature, the Christ intelligence in nature. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? That's a strange statement. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? We just discovered that there were two types of people. Right-thinking people, we call them godly, and the negative thinking or the ungodly. Now all of a sudden we got the heathen. How did he get in the picture? Somebody is different than the heathen? What does the heathen really mean? Yes. When we refer to a heathen, we refer to someone who is ignorant of the principles of life and thought. So they say, why do the heathen rage? That means get into frenzy. Why do negative mind-wandering people get into states of frenzy? And the people imagine a vain thing. And the people around start to assume that his frenzy or rage is real. But it's not real, it's just a vain act. It's only a projection of his low emotional nature. So it goes on to describe the heathen raging and the people's imagination about the heathen. The non-right-thinking individual is going to set up mind-wandering in the environment and assume certain types of position about themselves. Sooner or later would create discord. So here we go on. It says now, the kings of the earth, those individuals who are at the head of nations are ruling individuals, set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Politicians detest the fact that the religious order is the basis of a continuous prosperity in a nation. Church and state are in conflict already. It's not a new idea. It's as old as man will always be. He cannot see the particular reason for governing by a divine order. He's got to set himself as a king, as a ruler, apart from the rest, and take counsel how to act. Governing people. So there is that conflict against church and state. The two are in conflict. Now here's a mantra or is an affirmation that is dealing, or a science of the thought pattern that is dealing with church and state. And it tells you how we should do it. Our politicians and the counselors will do this setting apart. They take counsel against the Lord and against his anointing. That is, they don't accept divine authority and they don't accept the individuals who are attuned to this authority in consciousness. Now, there's a big difference between a priest and a realized man. coming forward in the form of a prophet or a wise man to help mankind. The church and the state are in different situations now. The church may be a church functioning as an organization, but it may not have a realized man at its head. Let us break their hands asunder. Let us break their hold upon our society. You don't literally mean go take the society has got a stranglehold upon it by the church. We saw this in Mexico when the church came and had a stranglehold upon the Mexican people. And the councilors of Mexico, or the men in political power, literally broke that stranglehold. Let us break their hands asunder and cast away their cords from us. That means, let us break this churchianistic hold upon society and remove the strings that tie them to us, the roots from where they came from, their origin. Free us from this. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall have them in derision. Well, this is what happened in Mexico at one time, when the church was slaughtered by politicians. The priests that came there, they were not allowed to carry on. After a long while, church and state separated, to the point that there was no ceremony performed in the country, except it being secret. Then it came along in Russia and some other countries. This is still going on, the constant conflict between church and state. Now, then shall he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. The highest consciousness will cause the politician to be more and more malicious, or more and more vindictive in suppressing the activity of the church. We find this a great deal in the dictatorial environments. Now, when you come to your democratic environments, you see the situation, there's a counterbalance. There is some degree of communication, some degree of association between church and state. They are retaining some of their power and working with this power together. Yet have I set my king upon thy holy hill of Zion. This statement indicates that the leader is attuned to the Father. It's a big difference. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. That individual or leader of the state is in attunement with God. He is not setting himself apart or setting up himself as a ruler over a country without the direction of God. See, are opposed to God. This individual is asking God to guide him through the entire reign of his country.
rulership of this country. That's a vast difference. When we begin to see how the church and state will now come together. I will declare the decree. I will make this statement. The Lord hath said unto me, Thou art my son. Now this is the highest combination of priest, king, realized king. There were such men at one time, kings who were fully realized saints, kings who were masters in their own right. This day have I begotten thee. Well, for instance, there was a king called Janak of India. He was a fully realized man and a king at the same time. Buddha, he was a king, a prince, and he was fully realized. Krishna, he was a king, and he was fully realized. Ashoka, he was a king, and he was fully realized. There were many, like Solomon was a king, and he was realized. You see, in the whole spectrum of history, some kings were realized. What happened to us? We deviated from it because we did not understand it. Now, here is what happened. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen for thy inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. Ask of me, and I will give thee the heathen for thine inheritance, and the uttermost parts of the earth for thy possession. But how we respond to that promise, how we make use of that promise, makes all the difference of where we are today. If we misuse that utterance or that promise, we are in a position in which we are in conflict with the divine law. If we didn't abuse it and we use it correctly, then we would not be in conflict with the divine law. We would really be experiencing now a higher form of spiritual life within a government.
Individual in a free
free society, we can make these negative individuals who tend to trap us with our own laws fall apart like a crockery pot. It'll fall apart. They don't have anything substantial. You notice he used the word a potter's vessel? A crockery pot makes the most noise when it's empty. Now you remember the woman who petitioned the courts for the purpose of not having prayer in the school. She made a big noise about it. But substantially, did she have anything to replace it? Or substantially, did she have anything to offer in terms of human being and its behavior pattern? So she was nothing but an empty vessel making the most noise. But we didn't have the will like iron. We did not have the determination to stick by our faith in ourselves. Therefore, we were weakened by the thought pattern, and we lost out. We were destroyed by our own thinking. We have to get back to that thinking, which we can be like a rod of iron, which is determination. We got to be more determined. You know, we are actually producing a race of people totally unafraid to do good. Or more afraid to do good, which is it? People, if we're unafraid to do good, then we will not be afraid to face the issue. If we are afraid to do good, we will run from the issue. Now, if our people are afraid to look at themselves objectively, no matter what ideas come up, we can face the issue and come to a better agreement than to give in to the ideas that tend to destroy us ethically, morally, and spiritually, or physically. Consciously and unconsciously, both. They were doing it. It's like a child. It sees a revolver on the table. It does not know the danger of the revolver. It's loaded, but because it's enticed, it wants to reach up to play with it. The parent knows that the gun is loaded and it can kill, but it tries to take it away, and the child is offended because the parent can use it. The child can't use it. When a child comes of age to use it, it will be a different thing. It can be trusted. Equally true, when individuals who have no sense of the workings of the human consciousness and spirit and body are allowed to dictate the behavior patterns of society as a whole in terms of how men should evolve, those who are in a position to have the right perspective or vision, should they let them take hold of that particular legal weapon, then anything that happens to us after that is our own mistake or own fault. The only way that the untrained individual can create a problem is to have legislation organize itself around the ethical systems of living. That it would be impossible for ethical people to survive. But when you want to be truly evolving and to know how to evolve, you have to have this consciousness to see it and correct it.
So they grow up spiritually.
They would be able to take over and handle it properly. So it's that sense of direction that we have to impart to the individual. Now comes the admonition. It tells us what the kings have done. It tells us what the church and the state have done among themselves. They split themselves apart. And they have left themselves in a state in which those individuals who don't have an iron will are defeated. But those who have an iron will stand triumphant. Then the admonition to the king is not the admonition to the priest, admonition to the king, because they have triumphed. Be wise now, therefore, O ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. See? Political authority backed up by legal order. King, judge, be wise. In other words, you are judged now above and by your behavior in terms of ethics. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Well, the fear implied here is not the fear that we know it to mean. It is the old Hebrew word meaning respect, awe. If we have no respect or awe for the legal framework that governs our behavior as a discipline, then we become lawless. We take the law into our own hands, and eventually we will destroy ourselves. This is the meaning of he who lives by the sword will perish by the sword. He who lives by the self-motivation of an uncontrolled mind will destroy himself by that same self-motivation. We must have some type of order or organization to maintain balance. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Now the trembling don't mean it's illness. When you rejoice, you tingle all over. Have you ever rejoiced and feel happy? And how do you feel? Like your whole body is shaking, vibrating, right? It is this particular type of shaking that is being inferred, trembling. You know, it's like, feels so good. Good. You know that song, how it goes? You are vibrating or tingling all over in the rejoicing of that consciousness. If you accept a king or rule yourself, meaning the same thing, by a wise man who is both attuned to the ideas of state and church, then you are living in an environment conducive to the highest good. If you're living in an environment that is not attuned to both and is in constant conflict with each other, then sooner or later you're going to find you're in an environment that is going to lead you to self-destruction. We find that in the history of every nation. History repeats itself, that's why it's called karma. When the Jews were under David and Solomon, they prospered. And then after, when they got down into the other kings, who slowly started to cut themselves away from the synagogues, they soon became weak, and then the Romans took over their country. You go back into the history of other nations. When they were attuned to their religious beliefs, they attained a high level of control over their environment. The moment they had conflict with their religious beliefs, they were torn down by their neighboring nations and taken away. We saw that in Egypt. We saw that in many of the Indian tribes. We saw that in Persia. We saw that among the Hebrew people. We see that in the Chinese people. All the way in Europe, all coming through. When there was a conflict between the church and the state, the neighboring tribes struck and took away what they had. The Greeks had the same thing. Anytime the church and state went into conflict by the ruling class, the neighboring countries struck and took their country. It is the way the Lord works, as he means to bring us back to the right picture. Now it tells you, when you found that particular king, how you should act that rules with harmony between church and state. Kiss the Son. That means recognize or embrace, take unto yourself the enlightened king, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are they that put their trust in him. Very good example is Akhenaten, the Egyptian king who brought monotheism to Egypt. When the people embraced monotheism, the church and the state began to function. Those priests who joined Akhenaten built a great society. But those priests that were against Akhenaten, for the sake of the people, caused something to occur. Akhenaten was assassinated. But those who embraced the king, or those who adhered to the king, during that entire period, Egypt reaches highest unfoldment in art and literature. It thrived the most, it gained the most, it produced the most in constructive thinking. As soon as he was assassinated, everything about Akhenaten was turned down. And those ideas no longer thrived in Egypt. But we see the history of Egypt after Akhenaten. It was one of pillage, one of constant raiding by their neighbors. Today they are reduced to what we call a second-rate nation, only backed up by another military power to have a face in world politics. Now, surrounding the entire Egyptian belt and the Arabian belt, there's little David, Israel, small little group of people. They're in conflict too with their religion and state. If they don't stay together, then they will fall apart. As long as they will stay together with their religion and state activity, then they will be a bulwark. They have the lesson to learn. In this modern age, their lesson is trying to hold together the religious ideals of their ancestors. Yes. Yes, there are tremendous reformations going on, because the church and state are trying to be not overly identified with each other like in the olden days, and they're trying to maintain and follow the pattern of Washington. Now, Washington's pattern can set a very inharmonious program for them if they keep following Washington's pattern. Washington's pattern can correct itself if church and state will get together, not overstepping the boundary lines, but respecting each other's personal boundary lines in terms of functioning as a whole. So they have to learn the lesson too, that they can't always pattern after every condition they see around the world. They have to bring back their own intrinsic traditional patterns of church and state to function as a people. Now, the only reason the Arab states and the Egyptian states stay together is because of long hatred for the Israelite, ancestral traditional hatred, the vendetta. You take away that and they collapse. They will have nothing to fight for. See, the Arab cannot have anything to fight for, because what did he fight for? Unless he doesn't have a common hate, he has nothing to fight for. And his common hatred based back not from the oil fields, it based back way back in time, going back to the time of Abraham and the son Ishmael and the son Isaac. Their ancient hatred is so old, so deep-rooted, that it's become now like a genetic virus. But because they were prolific people, there are more Arab states densely populated than the Israelite states. And the Israelites are a very small group of people. No. So you have a tremendous force field locked up in there. Now, if the Third World War would begin, there is the actual spawning ground for your Third World War. Because here, history must repeat itself. Egypt will still like to retain her glory as she was. What would Israel do? Israel would want to retain her glory as she was. Now, in a world confrontation of people, you have now different religious organizations all over, and the largest controlling body of religious movement scattered in all nations, not one single nation, but in all nations, is Christianity, which is the offspring of Judaism. So how can Christianity and Judaism avoid the confrontation of the other religious organizations in the other countries with their different patterns of thinking? They will be forced to get together. Now, the Hindu, the Mohammedan, the Christian, only the Mohammedan fights holy war. His constant battle is the holy war. Islam is a constant battle of holy war. From the time it was spawned, it's holy war. Now, it's fighting Christianity and it's fighting Hinduism. Hinduism is not a proselytizing religion. It does not go out to get, like missionaries trying to get students. Christianity goes out to get students. So, the Creator has already brought about opposition by setting up certain forces to keep each in check and balance. By allowing Christianity to spread into every nation on a missionary basis, and allowing Islam to spread into many nations on a missionary basis, so they both are confronted by holy war.
Do you think Christ really meant the churches to send missionaries to convert a good Buddhist to a Christian?
Christ merely said, "Come, I will make you fishers of men." Really meaning, "Come, I'll make you fishers of the soul." He didn't intend that one try to convert another or change him from his belief. He intended that one, by virtue of his example of living, would make other men lift up their souls, fish out for themselves where the soul is, would look for the soul in themselves by the virtue of exemplary living. If you live the exemplary life of the science of the soul, other men, no matter what their creed or belief was, suddenly would realize this, and it would spark them to live this exemplary life. Therefore, all men are brothers in the one Father. Now, Jesus was smart. He said, "I didn't come to destroy or condemn. I came to fulfill." Fulfillment means I came to live by example, by demonstration. And he who would do the will of the Lord is my brother and my sister and my mother. This applied to any man, regardless of what his belief was. Merely doing the will of the Lord. Now, I don't know of any religion that goes against that. Hinduism teaches the will of the Lord. Buddhism teaches the will of the Lord. And Islam teaches the same thing. And I think the French people has a word for it, que cela sera. What will be. It's the will of the Lord. I don't know of what action a human being can take in terms of all the religious patterns, the scientific patterns, that would not be involved in doing the will of the Lord. It has to be obeyed. So, Jesus was not trying to say that he was coming to bring people back and let his students go out and convert. In fact, there's a big transformation occurring now among the Christians. The priests in the Catholic Church are becoming Christians for the first time in India. They have to go to India to learn Christianity. The Catholic Digest has a book, a whole article on it. That the church in India, being a minority group, was trying to raise the Christian roll call by incorporating more and more people into it. Come to find out they can't even Christianize the Indian. They're being Indianized by the Indian. The priests are being Indianized. In other words, they're discovering the Christian way via the Indian method. They're seeing Christ in a different aspect. Many people are going there to study now how and why the Christ of the Indian is different. Well, he is different only because Christ studied in India. He was an Oriental. He wasn't a Western man. He wasn't a Roman. He was a Jew. And the Jew was a Middle Eastern man. And the seat of learning was in the East. And the disciple relationship was the oldest method of learning. And passing it down, India carried on that tradition. And today, the church is now realizing that it's the only way they could accept the new concept of Christ. And not churchianity. Churchianity is dying and Christianity is being born for the first time. Now, we notice that the two psalms that we cover, one is the happiness of the two types of people that exist. One is the type of government or association with the church, how to live with it. You see a pattern form? You see a plan being formed? One is leading to the other? What type of people? And then how they should govern themselves and what they should adhere to? Now we come to the third psalm, which gives you individual relationship. It's called the security of God's protection. Here is a science building up for the first time. The first psalm tells you which one the two type of people you want to be, positive or negative, so you have to make your choice. The second psalm tells you your social structure in which you're in. Each one is in his own environmental karma to grow up. And what is required of him to stand up for his rights in this environmental karma to make it work. Now comes the third condition. How much trust you have in your ideal. To back up what you're saying and put it to the test, and who is going to protect you when you go wrong? So you want God's protection now. The third psalm is finding security in God's protection. So it says, Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Haven't you been that route before? Don't you recognize some of that pattern in your everyday living now? Without you living here in America and you're trying to decide between being following a certain way of life with your friends and your relatives, and all of a sudden now you want to know, have you made the right decision? Have you chosen the right place to be? And who are the people that you're associating with? Are they really thinking along these lines? So in your mind you're saying, what am I doing here? Lord, how are they increased that trouble me? Many are they that rise up against me. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. Are you familiar with such ideas? Have you not been around people? Hey, you're wasting your time. What are you trying to do? Pray to God. Like Adano, he's talking here at the school, and he said, oh, God can take care of it soon. And somebody said, you're crazy, why don't you take the vitamin tablets and drink the Coca-Cola? See, there always going to be that particular condition in which we're in. To hold you and pull you and work with you. But you have to go through these processes to know what is karma. What is being a channel for other people's karma? And what is environmental stress in order to transcend both types of karma? The soul is now turning to the Lord. It must learn to rely on the Creator as the guiding principle for its existence. And that's how we are lifted up by example. We learn the spiritual life par example, not by reading. It's by living the thing with that consciousness. Many there be which say of my soul, there is no help for him in God. Then here comes a big Hebrew word, Selah. When translated, Selah only means so be it. That's what it means. In other words, I can't do nothing, Lord. You take over from here now. You get the idea? You got to surrender to a point where this intelligence will come in and zap you, shape up, and fly right. You know, it's one of those things. But thou, O Lord, art a shield. He didn't say, art my shield. Thou, O Lord, art a shield. The constant attunement is a bulwark, a protective measure. Hallowing the holy name in your meditation now. That's where we come back to repetition. Repeating the psalm or the affirmation now is your shield. This is the shield. This is what builds up the wave. This is what is God is the sun. If you say, I am my Father one, 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 I am my Father one. This is your shield. This will build up this force against that pulling power of those. O Lord, art a shield for me. Now you are specifying to yourself what the shield is for. Who it is, you the individual involved. My glory, that is, when I succeed in using this technique, I can get the last laugh on you. Get the idea? That's my glory. And the lifter up of mine head, that means like I transcend now above the sensory pull of the environment and the tensions and the anxiety. You get the idea? You're actually raising yourself up above those levels. I cried unto the Lord with my voice. That means I don't give up affirming or repeating the holy name inside. Hallowed be thy name. Whatever you're saying inside, japa, mantra, simran, whatever it is, repetition or hallowing, do not quit. In other words, keep on going. Yogananda says, God, Christ, Gurus, this is his battle cry. And he calls it a battle cry, God, Christ, Gurus. And in sleeping, eating, meditating, divinely loving, in sickness, dying, and everything, he's still shouting inside, God, Christ, Gurus. He's not quitting, because God, Christ, Gurus have all the power in it to get him out of the dilemma. So what is that lesson? The forces of unrighteousness are strong, my son, but the forces of righteousness are stronger still. That's the lesson. You're learning in this in meditation, you're learning it in your psalms. You're learning that the more you will remain firm, like a rod of iron, you will smash the environment that appears to be like a clay bowl. They're giving off lots of noise. A clay bowl looks strong, and a brass rod is strong. Sooner or later, when they clash, one's got to give way. It's that will, that drive, that staying power. I cried unto the Lord with my voice, and he heard me out of his holy hill. Well, you cry with your mouth. Everybody cries with their mouth out of anguish for something. And where would the creative intelligence hear you? You're not up in some mountain. The mountain is right here in your consciousness, at the point between the eyebrows. The intelligence tells you inside, right at this mountain between your eyes. It's called the Holy Hill. He heard me out of his Holy Hill. Then the next word again is this wonderful Hebrew word, Selah. So be it. If you cry out, if you are constantly repeating over and over, sooner or later that consciousness is going to fire off that particular power and release you and free you. He will hear it. That means the master gland, the master focal point inside of you, will trigger off the energy, and it will be divine will manifest. What will be, so be it. Then he says, I laid me down and slept. Now you see, what is the next procedure in the science? You yell your head off, and then you go to sleep and forget the whole cotton picking thing. Right? How many of us can project this thought and forget? Now, when you're sound asleep, you don't know if you're a man or a woman. So you must take in the scientific aspect of the consciousness and work it by sending the thought over and over and then go to sleep. It's a form of conscious exhaustion to the point of shutting it off. I awake, for the Lord sustained me. Now you can see the whole scientific principle of the science working. I awake, for the Lord sustained me. You repeat over and over, over and over, over and over, getting drowsy and drowsy and drowsy, and you go off into that state. And before you know it, your whole body is regenerated. That means sustained. It comes back. You are revitalized. The body is starting to correct itself. But you can't stop. You have to keep on that particular attunement inside. It says now, I will not be afraid. See, it's how this security, how this protective power is starting to build up in you now. How this programming, how this imprinting of the consciousness starts. I will not be afraid. That's a very positive statement. Of 10,000s of people, that's lots of people. The mass collective force field of 10,000 people negatively thinking against you. That have set themselves against me roundabout. Do you get what you are working with? What are the odds you're working in the science of the songs? By taking ideas and really hammering it away in consciousness? Now the challenge comes. 10,000s of people around you. And finally he says, arise, O Lord. That means energy within the spinal force field, the Kundalini force. Arise, O Lord. Save me, O my God, the vital power in you now. From the constant repetition, the holy power in you, you start to feel this energy going up your spine. Like if your head is going to pop. Your brain is now agitating to the point. And you feel like everything is pulling. Arise, O Lord, because vital power is God. The same vital power is in the 10,000s of people around you that can snap in them and can sustain you instead. Arise, O Lord,
save me, that means insulate my body and my emotional makeup against the concentrated, vital, magnetic, emotional force field of these 10,000 people. Save me, O my God, for thou hast smitten all mine enemies upon the cheekbone. Now it specifies where this force field is cut off in the individual. The vital energy is rising in you to offset the intense emotional stresses of others and blocking them at the cheekbone. Now, what are we saying is this: a man in intense hatred, his eyes are like that.